Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming up on Eating Matters, we'll be discussing the USDA's updated SNAP retailer requirements with Chuck Abbott. And later in the show, we'll be talking to the CEO of the food delivery service, Munchery. Stay tuned.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hi, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. Today, we're going to be talking about the USDA's proposed changes for retailers participating in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. This program is the largest in the domestic hunger safety net, and over 44 million Americans rely on it each month. According to the USDA, as of September 2015, over 250,000 firms were authorized to participate in SNAP, a number that increased by 12% since 2011. Recently, the USDA released its proposal to require retailers to supply a wider variety of healthy and whole foods for SNAP recipients, which has been met with a great deal of resistance. Chuck Abbott from the Inside Ag will join us in a bit to further discuss these changes, and then later in the show, we'll be joined by Tree Tran, co-founder and CEO of Munchery, our featured startup of the week. But before we get into our discussion on SNAP, I want to briefly discuss some of the biggest food policy stories in the past week. And in the studio with me today to delve into these topics is my associate producer, Taylor Lanzette. Taylor, this is her radio debut, and I am so excited to have you in the studio with me.
Thanks, Jenna. I'm excited to be here.
So let's jump right in. What's been going on in the wonderful world of food policy?
Yeah. So last Wednesday, the FDA released their long-awaited voluntary sodium reduction targets. This has been a decade-long battle with the Center for Science and the Public Interest, and they've been pretty much asking the FDA to just do better by setting sodium limits and advocating for changing the safe status of salt. The drafted short-term and long-term voluntary targets for the industry are intended to help the American public gradually reduce sodium intake to 2,300 milligrams per day, which is the recommended level by scientists and public health experts.
Right. So just for a little bit of context, average sodium intake right now in the U.S. is a whopping 3,400 milligrams, which is way more than, I guess, what they're suggesting it should be. And just to put in a public health reminder here, why we care about this is because when sodium intake increases, blood pressure increases, and high blood pressure is a risk factor for heart disease and stroke, which also happen to be two leading causes of death in the U.S. So the public health community probably thinks this is a pretty big deal.
Right.
You're like, yes. What happens next?
So right now, the draft guidelines are open to public comment. And once the agency reviews those comments, they'll publish a final guide. But even with that, it just remains a guide. So it's voluntary. And the ultimate targets for the industry are, you know, what they're aiming to achieve is 10 years down the road, meaning we might not see these things till 2027 or 2028, depending on how fast the FDA works.
Not very always. I think this is great because, you know, it shows like, I mean, we've heard from big companies like Nestle, which is the world's largest food company, Mars, another, you know, behemoth it's been in terms of the food world. And then recently Unilever and PepsiCo joining the likes of the American Heart Association, CSPI, Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. So these groups kind of seem like strange bedfellows, but I think it really represents like a big step change and industry plus public health working to move forward on this issue. Yeah. Okay. Also, I also have to give a shout out to New York City. I love, one of my favorite parts of the show is when I get to do this, but the health department and the city, of course, way ahead of the curve. I want to remind everybody that the New York City Health Department launched its own National Salt Reduction Initiative in 2008, targeting sodium in processed foods and chain restaurants. And in a statement released on Friday, Sonia Angel, the deputy commissioner of the city's Division of Prevention and Primary Care, reminded everybody that New York City was a trailblazer and pushed the FDA to set these voluntary limits. So kudos to the health department. And then also one more plug, this past Monday, New York City, the high sodium warning labeling rules went into effect officially at chain restaurants. So
kudos to New York.
Yes, leading again. Done.
So next up.
Yeah, yeah. You're like moving on.
We have cotton in the news. So on Tuesday, the USDA announced that they will pay $300 million to cotton producers to offset some of the ginning costs. And so this is really an effort to bring stability to the industry that's seen major declines from just generally increases in global production of cotton.
Mm-hmm.
And so the USDA is hopeful that their new cotton ginning cost share program will provide temporary relief to many of the stakeholders in the cotton world. And the cost share payments are capped at $40,000 per individual or business, and folks in the industry can sign up between June 20th and August 5th. And cotton allies and lobbyists are already thinking, you know, this is obviously not going to be enough. And Michael Conaway, the House Ag Committee Chairman, has requested that the USDA designate cotton seed as an oil seed so it can be eligible for commodity support programs in the 2014 Farm Bill.
So does this mean that cotton's not currently treated like a food staple commodity crop, and they're basically trying to designate it as such?
Seems that way.
Okay, well, and then they're definitely going to maybe have a fight, because it seems like there are a lot of other, you know, things that could be subsidized, like, quote, specialty crops?
Vegetable,
a.k.a. vegetables. Yeah. Okay.
You know, and the last thing we'll sort of dive in today is atrazine. And so atrazine is the second most widely used weed killer in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And last week, the EPA released a report that the pesticide possesses a serious threat to many birds, mammals, fish, and frogs.
Right. And the backstory here is that the EPA, you know, they need to do this. They need to reevaluate pesticides every 15 years, is it? And the last time this was done was 2003.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So atrazine is in the hot seat.
Mm-hmm.
And just for some general context, farmers use about 70 million pounds of atrazine a year.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like a lot.
And 90% of that, so most of it's used on corn, but it's also sprayed on soybeans and sugarcane, wheat and oats. And not surprisingly, Europe has already banned atrazine.
Of course.
And so U.S. environmentalists are pushing the EPA to do the same. And if you're interested in learning more about atrazine, one of my favorite TED Talks is by UC Berkeley researcher Tyrone Hayes, who pretty much has explored how atrazine is linked as an endocrine disruptor in sexual development of frogs.
Fascinating.
It really is. It's a great talk.
All right. Well, we'll check it out. And then just a reminder, so the draft report is on the EPA's website, and it's open for comments for the next 60 days. So if you have, if you're inspired after watching the TED Talk or whatnot, comment. Okay, that wraps it up for our new segment today. Be sure to tweet or direct message us at EatMattersHRN if you would like to include a particular policy update, or if you have thoughts on the ones that we discussed today. Okay. Now we're going to turn to the topic at hand, discussing the USDA's proposed changes to its requirements for retailers participating in the $80 million program. Under the USDA's proposal, in order for a store to participate in food in this program and accept SNAP benefits, retailers will now have to stock a wider variety of foods than in the past. So specifically, they would need to stock a minimum of 168 items, including 7 varieties of food in the 4 staple food groups, plus perishable items in at least 4 of the food groups, with a depth of stock defined as 6 stocking units. So let me just break that down. 7 times 4 times 6 for those of us who had a hard time following that. By the way, the 4 food groups, staple food groups, are considered to be meat, poultry or fish, bread or cereal, vegetables or fruit, and dairy. If this is sounding fairly abstruse, suffice it to say that the USDA's proposal would ensure a broader variety of nutritional food options that encourage healthy cooking at home, so more real whole food options for people participating in the program. Joining me on the line today to dig into the details of this proposal, what the response has been to it, and what it means to people relying on this very important program is Chuck Abbott, editor of Ag Insider, published by the Food and Environment Reporting Network, who has covered food and ag issues in Washington for 3 decades. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, just great. Good. Happy to hear from you.
Well, we're really excited to have you back. Let's just start at the beginning. What prompted these changes, and when were the proposed changes first released?
Well, the changes are required under the 2014 the 2014 Farm Law, which was itself 5 years in development in Congress. And it's, Congress specifically said USDA needed to revamp the question of what staple foods would be offered by stores participating in the food stamp program. And the goal from all this was to provide a greater variety of healthy foods for lower-income Americans. USDA put out its proposal in February 16th of this year. It's a fairly lengthy document, like all sorts of proposed regulations. It made 3 major changes, or proposed 3 major changes.
Okay.
First was as I just said, it broadened the variety of foods that must be offered by stores that want to redeem food stamp benefits. It would change the definition of who is a store that can participate in the program by saying retailers are ineligible for the program if they get more than 15% of their receipts from sale of prepared food, hot food, foods that are prepared and served hot either before or after purchase in the store.
Okay.
This includes all revenue from in the store, not just revenue from food stamp sales. And third, it tightens the definition of what is a staple food.
Okay.
That's important because it gets back to the question for the people who run stores with a limited amount of square footage, of how many items do they have to have on the shelves in order to satisfy the government regulation.
Okay, so 3 major changes proposed, the first of which I kind of went into a little bit of detail in the intro. Then you mentioned the 15%. So if you get 15% or more of your total sales from a cooked or heated on site, you're not eligible. Can we talk about this? Like what? I'm a little bit, the 15% feels a little bit arbitrary. What was the rationale behind this cutoff?
Well, USDA held 5 listening sessions around the country as part of preparing this proposal. And in its Federal Register notice, it says that at the moment the cutoff is 50%.
Oh. Well, that's quite a difference.
But the information that it gathered during the listening sessions and other work that he did in preparing for the to write the regulation, said that, that a stricter cutoff point was appropriate. And in the in the Federal Register notice, USDA talks about it doesn't want restaurants, in the food stamp arena. That's because the food stamp program, and the USDA says this repeatedly, is designed to provide foods for preparation and consumption at home.
Right, but why? Yeah. I mean that makes sense. But why? I mean, that's a big difference. But like, do they think that there's fraud, happening? Do they think that there are restaurants currently accepting SNAP benefits?
Well, it basically was to make sure restaurants are not part of the program. Because except in limited circumstances, the food stamp programs just provide groceries for meals at home, not restaurant food. And USDA and the Federal Register notice talked about how there were retailers who would sell, for instance, a frozen pizza to someone, mm-hmm. and then say, hey, for an additional certain amount of money, or even for free, throw it in our microwave, and it's good to go. And USDA, in its proposal, says, well, now they've effectively become a restaurant. They're serving hot food.
Oh.
They're serving a meal to somebody, but they've taken food stamp money for it.
Got it.
Because you talked about the 15% cutoff point, that has become probably the leading complaint from convenience store operators. And convenience store operators are 40% of all the firms that are authorized to redeem food stamp benefits. There's about 260,000 firms in the United States that are part of the food stamp program. And there's, 106,531 firms that are convenience stores that are part of the program. That's USDA's latest count of the year. Firms that are part of the program.
Right. So this would effectively disqualify your typical, like, New York City corner bodega that does offer fresh food a lot of times and healthy options, but also seems to do a fair amount of business serving prepared foods as well.
It certainly could. When the House Agriculture Committee held a hearing on the future of food, they call it the future of food stamps, and they brought in retailers on May 12th, Douglas Beach, who was the director of government relations for Casey's General Store, and I could interject here, that Casey's General Store is a chain of convenience stores has more than 1,900 outlets throughout the Midwest, the Plains, and the Mid-South.
Mm-hmm.
In his testimony, Mr. Beach said that 40% of the total food sales for Casey's come from prepared food items. Now, that's not quite the same as saying hot food, but it gives you an idea. Casey's, sells a lot of prepared food. I mean, in his testimony, he made the point that Casey's sells, it's supposedly famous for selling pizza.
Right.
And he said that the proposed program, by altering the eligibility requirements, would push all of our stores and tens of thousands of other small format retailers out of the food stamp program because they make such a large volume of their revenue from prepared foods, which would, of course, include hot foods. He said that they did a survey, and their analysis was that 220 of their stores are the only store in a community, the only grocery store in the community, that takes food stamps. So you can see that this is the concern, what do they call it, threat, that the small the operators of smaller stores have raised, that this 15% cutoff point is just set too high.
Right.
And members of Congress, like Senator Jerry Moran from Kansas, who's the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee that handles the USDA budget, he alluded to that concern during a markup on the USDA appropriations bills issue.
Right.
The concern that, you know,
so,
store operators in this state were saying we might not be in the business anymore. Taking food stamps.
Right. And so the proposal also says that the definition of staple foods would change. Can you just go over what the definition is now and what the USDA is proposing?
Okay. Well, this is one of the points where it's a little arcane, but the impact can be profound. A staple food is defined, you know, the USDA says staple foods, there's four categories of them.
Mm-hmm.
Dairy, fruits and vegetables, bread and cereals, and meat, poultry, and fish. One of the things that's done by changing the definition of staple foods is it says that multiple ingredient items will no longer be counted toward satisfying the staple food requirements. So this means that macaroni and cheese, pizza, frozen dinners, they won't count as multiple ingredient foods. At the moment, they do.
Mm.
And USDA, one of the reasons USDA uses in justifying this change in definition is it says, well, you know, something like chicken pot pie now would be, under the current rules, is a staple food. And then the current rules, essentially the department looks at what's the first ingredient on the list of ingredients on the package.
Okay.
In this case, you know, it says, well, you know, some chicken pot pies, bread is the first thing that's mentioned. Other brands, chicken is the first thing that's mentioned. So it says, well, you could have a situation then where one convenience store could stock two types, you know, two different brands of chicken pot pies and say it's satisfying the meat and the bread and cereals requirement.
Huh. Which totally defeats the purpose of...
Right, yeah. It defeats the purpose of... We want a broader array of healthy foods.
Right. And has there been a lot of pushback with this particular proposal, more so or less so than the 15% cutoff?
There has been. This has gotten a lot of attention within the industry. You know, like the same day that the USDA released its proposal, analyses and started circulating. It was mostly, most of this, while a big deal within the food industry,
mm-hmm.
was pretty, you know, it wasn't a topic of general discussion. It eventually bubbled to the surface when it became closer to the time for the House and the Senate to begin the appropriations process, because the House and the Senate both in their USDA funding bills for the new fiscal year, which begins October 1st, in both cases, the appropriations committees have included riders that say USDA cannot go forward with this proposal. And this is built partly around, you know, the loud opposition from the food, from food retailers. The National Association of Convenience Stores put in a public comment calling for USDA to be, just to totally withdraw the proposal.
Okay.
There were 1,200 public comments on this rule.
Right.
That's a pretty good response. I mean, it's not like the Waters of the United States rule, which is an attempt by EPA to further clarify clean water.
Yeah.
The Clean Water Act, which got like a million responses. But now there are proposed regulations that go out there, and they might get like four or five replies.
Wow. Okay. So it was pretty controversial.
Yeah. Within the food sector, yeah, this is
a big deal. I want to talk about the appropriations process in a minute. Like when we come back from break, I want to kind of dig into like the actual processes and where we are with this proposal and what the outcome or the forecast kind of looks like for its potential passage. But I wanted to ask one question before we go to break, and the thing that I kind of struggle with in listening to these, these proposed changes, like redefining staple foods so that pizza can't, cannot count in like two different categories, let's say, or, you know, the drive to stock more healthier options, and the pushback being that it's burdensome. I guess it's hard for me that there's still such a huge divide between the public health and the anti-hunger community. And I'm like, shouldn't we all just agree that the recipients of federal food assistance should have access to healthful food choices? Like, why do you think that this is still an issue that we see played out in federal policy?
Yeah, well, it's an issue because, like the Douglas Beach from Casey's, his example of it, he says they have relatively small stores, like 4,800 square feet at the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of their stores are in rural areas. They get a delivery. They get a delivery truck comes around once a week. And he says, like, a lot of the items that they stock on their shelves, they only have like two or three of them. But the USDA proposal says you have to have a stocking depth of six items for each of these varieties of food in each of the categories. Right? So his argument is like, you know, it's just, you know, logistically difficult to get that much material into the store, and then it's going to sit there for so long that some of it's going to spoil, particularly the perishables. So that, you know, the cost of meeting the requirement is, you know, much greater than USDA's estimate of, you know, only a couple hundred dollars for the additional items. So it just goes back to, you know, the food industry and the food retailers, like the rest of the industries. They're just worried. You know, they're averse to outsiders setting the rules.
Yeah,
right. I disagree with Jenna on this on this point, in that I want as many places as possible to accept SNAP to make it easier for people to be able to use their SNAP benefits. But I guess, you know, like, I'm curious what you think in terms of, is this just a simple supply and demand issue of businesses not wanting to change their inventory when SNAP makes no guarantee that the participants will actually purchase those items? Or why, you know, the differing camps here, what do you think in terms of, you know, why more of these corner bodegas can't offer a bounty of vegetables?
It's just been covered in studies of food deserts and other problems in getting, you know, supplies of fresh and healthy foods to people. I mean, some of it really is the question of turnover at the store.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of it, you know, it's, you know, a package of rice or a prepared, frozen dinner is going to stay, you know, in saleable condition a lot longer than, you know, a bunch of bananas that's sitting on the counter next to the cash register. It is for some operators, it's just difficult to get, you know, to be able to stock the merchandise and have enough of on hand for when people are going to want to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yes, I do think that these changes, they are great, and I really hope that they move forward, especially with the, you know, in terms of the variety of healthy foods that should be stocked. But obviously, I also want to make sure that there are enough retailers that can participate in a given area, so that everyone can really access and use their SNAP benefits. But I realize that's hard. That's very tricky. Okay, you know what? We're running a little over, so we're going to take a really quick commercial break, and then when we can come back, Chuck, I've got a couple more questions for you, and then we will move on to our startup of the week.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're speaking with Chuck Abbott from the Food and Environment Reporting Network about the USDA's updated SNAP retailer requirements, or their proposed SNAP retailer requirements. Okay, so before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about access and both Taylor and I's viewpoint. And Chuck, I'm curious what you think this means, these proposed changes mean for the likelihood of SNAP maybe being accepted at other less traditional places like farmers markets, which of course is, you know, increasing in popularity as in terms of an access point for using your SNAP benefits, but also online retailers who aren't currently allowed to participate in the program. Do you think that this could kind of move the needle on having the USDA think a little bit more creatively about who can provide these healthy food options?
USDA has been very, very quiet on those sort of issues, and in a lot of cases, this would require, you know, the usual rulemaking process in which USDA has stated it's identified a need and decided to see whether there are whether there's demand in that particular area. But one thing that, you know, food stamps amounts to about 9% of grocery sales across the country, according to the Food Marketing Institute.
Okay, wow.
Which represents, you know, supermarkets.
Yep.
And, you know, one of the fascinating facts I learned, 82% of food stamp benefits are redeemed by supermarkets and superstores,
okay.
which is not terribly surprising because a lot of people shop at big places.
Right.
Convenience stores, who have been the most vocal in opposing USDA regulation, they account for 5% of food stamp benefits. And things like direct marketing, that's like, you know, it's a hundredth of a percent for only $5 million.
Yeah.
You know, last year. I should be able to find, I could find farmers markets. Farmers markets are 200ths.
Okay, so not very much.
But
a very important part, a very important part.
It's just like when you talk about, you know, you can say the convenience stores, you know, they're 5% of the benefits. Yet they're 40% of the stores. In some analysis, you could say 5% of the demand goes through there. That's not such a big thing to worry about. But, you know, the folks from these convenience stores will tell you, and, you know, in some cases, they're the only store in town.
Right.
Or they're the only store within easy walking distance of somebody's house.
And then the question becomes, is that where the majority of the people shop, or do they always go to the closest option, or do they try to find a way to kind of get to those bigger stores like your Walmarts, which isn't Walmart the largest recipient of SNAP retailer?
Walmart, well, yes, actually, both things. One, Walmart is the largest grocer in the United States, although it's not a grocery chain, but still it's the largest largest dollar volume of grocery sales, and yes. It also was has been the largest participant in the food stamp program.
Have they been?
And USDA studies have shown that food stamp participants, even if they don't have a car of their own, still find ways to get to, you know, to shop at larger stores. Whether they, you know, they get a hitch a ride with somebody else or on public transit, in many cases, like other shoppers, you know, they pay attention to, you know, they pay attention to price, and they're willing to go a little bit further to get a better price on groceries, or more a wider selection,
right?
Or they feel better quality.
Have you heard? Has Walmart been vocal in, you know, or out in front of any of these proposed changes at all? I'm just curious if you've heard anything.
The grocery chains the big grocery chains, have not said very much about this proposal. And for them, you know, the changes really won't matter.
Right.
Because, you know, they have huge amounts of, almost all their stores have, you know, huge amounts of square footage. If they run a deli or a salad bar with, you know, soup, hot, you know, hot soup and chili to go, that's still a small portion of their sales. And then, you know, they stock so many different foods that it doesn't matter to them if, you know, USDA says, as it proposes here, that, you know, that stores must have 7 varieties of food in the 4 categories, plus 3 varieties, you know, perishable items in 3 of those categories of staple foods. And they've got them. They got that stuff all over the place already.
Yeah.
Right. So, Chuck, what happens next, you know, right now, what's especially on the legislative front, what are we waiting for in terms of if the, you know, what's Congress, if they're blocking the appropriations bill, just what are the general changes in the proposal that are going to get pushed along?
Okay, well, the right now, we're if this is a Broadway show, it'd be where the musical intro is just start repeating itself, repeating itself, and it's called the vamping till ready. Because, you know, Congress has started doing appropriations bills, but doing very slowly. And we're starting to face the constraints of the calendar.
Congress slow? No.
There are appropriations bills that have to be passed every year. Congress has, in the last few years, had a poor record of getting all of them done on time. Last year, you know, Congress ended up doing an omnibus, everything in the kitchen sink into one bill, and they did it in December instead of the deadline of doing it by the time the fiscal year starts.
Right.
Anyway, get back to where I was a moment ago. So the appropriations committees in the House and Senate have approved their bills, so now we're waiting for floor debate. Under the textbook explanation of how a bill becomes law, the two chambers would pass a bill.
Mm-hmm.
They would have a conference committee, you know, with members from each chamber, which would agree on, would reconcile the differences, agree on the wording. They would take this compromise bill back to both chambers, pass it in both chambers, send it to the president, and the president would sign it. As I said, you know, we're facing the problem of the calendar because the presidential nominating conventions are scheduled for July. Most years, they're held in August, but this time around, they're being held in July, which means that there's, you know, about, four, you know, I mean, you know, looking at the calendar today, there's 4 or 5 weeks left before Congress takes off for the second half of July and all of August.
Right.
Because that's the summer recess. The plan then is to come back, work through September, and then take a break in October to go home and campaign for re-election, which means there's very little time left for Congress to agree on these bills.
Right.
So you can, you know, it's very, and we're also starting to get partisan, you know, hyper partisanship in Congress, so that, you know, the chances of things, of legislation moving become less and less. And one of the things that happens when you go to these omnibus appropriations bills, like they did last year, is that a very small number of people, you know, the leaders from each house, are involved in writing those bills, and a lot of the work that has been done by the Appropriations Committee gets erased.
Okay, great.
So, you know, when you come to forecasting the future, you know, it's not guaranteed that the Congress will pass a bill that, you know, a compromise bill that, it blocks USDA from going forward with this rule. It could, for its part, USDA has said that it's disappointed Congress wants to take a step backwards on providing healthy foods to families, and it says it's going to continue working on the regulation, and it intends to publish a final rule later this year.
So USDA is moving full steam ahead, and Congress is trying to block it, but probably, hopefully, will be unsuccessful. Is it?
Yeah, that's the basic outline.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for a discussion on SNAP today. Chuck, thank you so much for coming back on the show. For all of you listening, for more on Ag Insider and the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and to subscribe, go to thefern.org. Also, to celebrate their fifth anniversary, Fern published a print collection of their work called Dirt, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Food and Farming 2011 through 16. So be sure to check that out on their website as well. All right. Haha. Yes. Yes. That's right. It's time for our new segment, guys, the Startup of the Week, where we feature an innovative and new exciting food organization or company at the end of each episode. With that, I'm pleased to introduce Tri Tran, co-founder and CEO of the food delivery service Munchery, now operating in San Francisco, LA, Seattle, and New York. Tri, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us about Munchery and how it works.
Yeah, Munchery feature chef-designed, chef-crafted meals where we do the cooking ourselves, mm-hmm. and then we also deliver the food to you, whether home or office. So our key strength is we're pretty much a vertically integrated company where we source the ingredient, we do the prepping and cooking ourselves, mm-hmm. and we build all the technology to provide an experience where a customer can place orders, track their orders, and get delivery, the whole works, and get the feedback to, you know, whether they like the food or not the whole way. So yeah, we're in the four markets you mentioned, but that makes us having some key customer base that we hope to expand to additional cities here and as I talk. So
right now
to be here.
Oh, that's great. So I know that the market is, you know, it's a little bit crowded right now in terms of the food delivery meal kit services. Can you share with our listeners from like a consumer perspective, what really differentiates Munchery from the pack?
Yeah, there are a lot of companies for sure. I think people are familiar with probably the very popular Grubhub Seamless style where, mm-hmm. you know, there's a platform where you place order from a local restaurant. But then there are other companies who also provide delivery service from local restaurants. The key differentiator there is that all those companies leverage the food made at restaurant. And there's nothing wrong with restaurants in that, you know, you go into a restaurant, you order a dish and some cook or chef in the kitchen make it for you and put it right in front of you in the dining room for you to enjoy. That's great and all. But the second you put that into a box and then get that food later, like 30 minutes at best later,
yeah.
it's not meant for that purpose. Munchery, on the other hand, we exist for the single purpose of making food that is designed specifically for home delivery service. And so all of our chefs create these dishes, do careful R&D for all these dishes for this one and single purpose. And the food, therefore, is meant for you to enjoy at home. We deliver it chilled. We cook it and we chill it down, not frozen,
mm-hmm.
But we chill it and then deliver it to you chill, and then there's very simple and clear instruction right on the meal box for you to heat it up, whether in the oven or the microwave, and you get it exactly to be what the chef has intended it to be.
Oh, that sounds too good to be true. Amazing. What motivated you to start this company? You have a engineering background, right?
Yeah, I'm a techie by training and background, but it was definitely for a personal, selfish reason how the company got started, because in my little household, my wife does not cook. I'm the one who would do all the cooking.
Okay.
She's a classic city girl. She does not cook. She has no interest in learning how to cook, and maybe because she knows I would cook.
Yeah, there you go.
So I understand the pressure that the stereotypical women in the country would feel about at the end of the workday, and the question of what's for dinner weighs on you. And definitely I felt that pressure, and it's not just, you know, what are we going to cook today, but, you know, is it going to be any good if I'm going to cook something?
Or is my family going to want to eat it?
You know, there are other times, because we both work a lot, I would then order local takeout, and it's usually pizzas and things like that, where nothing wrong with pizza, but on a daily and weekly basis, that's not necessarily the best food for you.
Right.
So I was dreaming of, hey, how can I get convenient yet high-quality food at home? And mixing those two very opposing requirements was very hard to come about. And it took us a long time to do this, by the way. We've been in business for, what, nearly 5 years now? Okay. And finally cracking the code to make that happen.
Yeah, well, I wanna talk about that. Was there anything that happened early on that you realized just this is not working for us and you had to kind of subsequently pivot from? And, you know, what was that, if so?
There are a couple of changes. I think the chill format was right in the get-go something we had self-doubts about. Like, hey, would people really be able to do this, you know, with the chill model?
Right.
We know that, you know, a lot of people are used to local restaurant takeout. When you get it, you get lukewarm food, but you eat it right away. You don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
But we ultimately, you know, from customer feedback and our own gut decision saying, you know what, it gets you the best quality. I can bring you a fillet of fish. I can bring you a piece of medium rare steak in this format. And mm-hmm. that's incredible. And without overcooking it, without being mushy. Because if you're trying to keep it hot, by the way, you would overcook the protein and you would not get something that you would enjoy.
Yeah.
So that was one key thing that we decided earlier on and stuck with that, and turned out to be one of the biggest key advantage for us, because now we can deliver really far away and keep the food safe and all that really efficiently. We don't need to have a kitchen everywhere. I can talk about capital efficiency separately if you like. So that's one. And then mm-hmm. the second key thing for us is, initially, when the company started, it's kind of like an eBay. It's like a double-sided marketplace where Munchery, because I bootstrapped the company, couldn't hire anyone anyway. So, mm-hmm. you know, the chefs were independent chefs, like eBay sellers, and then customer were like buyers. That was okay until the demand picked up more, and none of these partner chefs wanted to cook a higher amount of food, because they're like, look, I make a living just fine,
right.
Cooking, you know, 50, 100 meals a day.
Yeah.
Why would I want to hire staff, take on more risk, and cook more when I'm just an independent partner? So we also decided to hire on our own culinary team a few years ago and provide them, you know, commercial kitchen facilities, additional staff, and then, you know, of course, tools and procedures and ways to be able to cook a lot of food at scale, at great quality. That's a big one.
Yeah, so and getting back to your point of you being vertically integrated now, so everything is
that's
that you
right.
would need is in-house. Interesting. Did you find, so you know, not having a food background, but founding and leading this company, did you find, like, you know, for all of those people out there who want to be food entrepreneurs, do you think it would be useful to have a background in the food industry? Or, like, what was the learning curve for you?
Yeah, I think there was a steep learning curve for sure. I had neighbors who were personal chefs that I talked to extensively. And then for the first couple years of the company, our so-called headquarter office is in a commercial kitchen. We literally rented an office room.
In a kitchen.
In a commercial kitchen. And that's where we learn a lot.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I wouldn't use that as a deterrent, but definitely right. trying to learn quickly on whatever field you want to get into.
Yeah.
So that's important.
Absolutely. And what better way to learn in the actual kitchen?
Yeah.
So one of the things I, you know, as I was kind of doing my research for this, I know that you guys provide a lot of variety, more so than sometimes a typical restaurant would be able to handle. And I'm wondering mm-hmm. how you can manage this from a cost perspective when purchasing. And also, second part of the question, if food waste is ever an issue for you guys, because you do offer so many different options.
Yeah. You know, we set out to have a mission for the company since the really, you know, early beginning, after the first, you know, just trial kind of period, is to be a dinner solutions to consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And making real food accessible to everyone everywhere is like our internal mission. To do that, you need to be a dinner solution on any given day. And a lot of our customers use our service multiple days during the week.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to have a fixed menu like a typical restaurant would, that's not going to achieve that, because people would then get tired of it. They're like, hey, I've seen that menu, you know, 50,000 times over or whatever,
right.
and it would not be exciting. So we decided in the very beginning that there needs to be daily changing menu. Mm-hmm. So a number of the dishes are brand new, coming on, or they were on last year, and now, you know, the season is in again for corn or tomatoes or whatever, we reintroduce it. So that's effectively a new dish because people haven't had it for like a year. So for us, that variety is really important to have because we want to be that dinner solutions to customer. Going back to how do we then operationalize that, you know, food margin is really thin, and how do we manage waste and things like that, that's when technology comes in. And that's when my background, my co-founder background, is really effective because we model customers' demand. We model what people would like based on their rating and their purchasing behavior of the dishes. Mm-hmm. We know what kind of protein sells better than the others. And then we also built tools so that our operations staff, our culinary operations, our inventory operations staff, can cook food in a very efficient and methodical way. So like all the recipes that, let's say you look at a typical recipe, most people would think of a recipe like what they would find in a cookbook, you know, like you would make this soup for five people or whatever. Mm-hmm. Our recipe is how do you make that for 500 or 5,000 units? And it's unfortunately not as linearly scalable as people might think it would be, you know, to cook soup for five people and then turning out to make it for 500. It does not mean you multiply every ingredient by 100 and then just follow the same steps. It does not work that way.
I would have gotten that wrong.
These things that we built tools for both on the supply side and predicting demand. There is a side effect to this in that some of the popular items do sell a little bit faster than others. Now we try and learn from that and adapt from that. But it's definitely a learning process for us for sure. Mm-hmm. And we do our best to meet that demand without making extra food and waste it. If we ever have extra food, if that ever happens, we work with local organization. We donate to them and they bring it to homeless shelters. They bring it to other places where the food is made use of. We don't actually trash anything if we ever have extra food.
Oh, that's great.
The other nice thing that we also do is we also donate capital. Uh-huh. For every order that our customers place, we donate money, the equivalent of what it takes a local food bank to make a meal for someone who can't even afford to buy a meal from us, right, or from anyone. We're really proud to report one of the largest donors for the San Francisco Marin Food Bank, and we do so for a local food bank in Seattle, in L.A., in New York, and everywhere mm-hmm. that we go.
Oh, that's wonderful and very, very much on topic with our discussion about SNAP, because we know it's a very important program, but sometimes it's not enough for families. And so to close that gap, a lot of Americans rely on their local food banks and soup kitchens. So I love to hear that you are not wasting any food and that you're also supporting those important organizations around you.
Yeah, in every organization, in every market that we're servicing, we have teams who obviously work there, live there. We want to be a positive contribution to the local communities that we're in. And what better way to do that in something that we know how to do well, and to help with that instead of just, you know, some potentially other volunteering project who leverage less than what we know how to do.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I think that's very powerful. Okay. Well, I'm gonna have to leave it there for today and wrap up. But Tree, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Jenna.
Absolutely. For more information on the company and to place your orders, go to munchery.com. All right, that's it for today. I want to thank both of our guests, Chuck Abbott and Tree Tran, for coming on the show. Also, thank you to our sponsors, of course, for your generous support. Our show is produced with the help of my brilliant co-hosts today, Taylor Lanzett and Austin Brynjarski. Show music is by Tim Archer, and our engineer is Pierre Benami. And David Tetashore. Yes, I nailed those names, you guys. Kind of. I got the waving of the hand, kind of. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe, like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook. And be sure to find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.